Welcome to episode 70 of Project Geekology, where we are nuclear tested and ready to go. I am one half of your host, Anthony, and joining me as always is...
Dakota, and yeah, actually, we are nuclear tested, but we're also, like, we're full of oxygen, guys, and we're ready to be destroyed.
Oxygen destroyed, that is.
Yes, oxygen destroyed. So we're going to be covering Godzilla, 1954, the original film that started off the huge kaiju trade. We're going to be covering the film that started off the big kaiju craze, Godzilla or Gojira from 1954. Obviously, we had, you know, King Kong that came out in the 30s. But from Japan's side of things, this was the big movie that just stemmed that entire franchise of Toho monsters. The universe that we love today about, like, giant monsters fighting each other, that all started here with Godzilla.
Right. This is the movie that kicked off the beloved giant lizard, a radioactive lizard.
Yes, so we're going to be covering everything that we can think of within an hour of Godzilla, whether it comes to the political or socioeconomic ramifications of, like, what they were trying to get across from that movie.
Yes.
To comparisons to newer movies, because I don't know about you, Anthony, but there was a lot of parallels between not only Godzilla Minus One, which we covered last week, the MonsterVerse. Like, there were certain character names that were just totally ripped from this original movie that were inserted in the MonsterVerse that we're going to talk about, and we're going to compare and contrast all of the different little things that make up this original movie. But Anthony, before we start any of that, what have you been up to lately?
Well,
and you know, better not say Persona.
I went to the theaters to actually watch this original Godzilla movie. No, I didn't. I did watch Godzilla 1954, and that was...
That would have been cool if you went to the theaters for that, though.
That would have been insane. Yeah, that would actually have been cool. But it was really cool revisiting that movie. I hadn't seen it in so long. So it was almost like rewatching it again for the first time, but also very similar because of after seeing Godzilla Minus One. But, you know, other than that, that game that, you know...
The game that we've decided you weren't going to talk about.
Absolutely.
Starts with a P, ends with a Ursona.
P Ursona. Yes, Persona 3 Reload.
Tell me
I've
about
been...
It.
So, for those of you, and I'm not sure if you know what Persona 3 Reload is. Persona 3 Reload is a remake of Persona 3, which was out on PS2, and they had it out for PSP. It was on PSP because it was Persona 3 Portable. And then they came out with another version that is called FES that adds, like, a whole other protagonist to it. This took the base game and remade it, but it kept the core story. It kept a lot of the the story beats and the characters. Honestly, it's been a really good time. I had played a little bit of Persona 3 on a PSP, but I didn't get too deep into it, especially when this was announced. I was like, oh, let me play this version. And I do want to go back and play the definitive version. FES, I think, is the version that a lot of people really love. So I do want to go back and play that eventually. Maybe as the other protagonist. There's like a male and a female protagonist in that. But Persona 3 Reload just focuses on the male protagonist.
Cool. So I'm assuming you're enjoying it because, you know, it's the big game that you're playing right now.
Absolutely. I mean,
yeah,
dude, how many times have I talked about Persona on this podcast? Like, a lot.
An abnormal amount of Persona discussion over the past couple of years. Years, plural. So
I'm a big fan of Persona 5 Royal, especially. I got my foot in the door with Persona 4 Golden. So I've been a Persona fan at least since the PS Vita days.
So as someone who's not familiar with these games literally at all, is Persona 5 Royal the name of the game?
So there's Persona 5 and then there's Persona 5 Royal. Royal is the updated version of the game where there's updated visuals, like avatars and minor things, but then it adds a whole extra character to it. The group within the game, they're called the Phantom Thieves. They go into this metaverse, and that's where they fight all these creatures, and it's like the dungeon crawling portion of the game. And so this Persona 5 Royal adds a new Phantom Thief and like an additional, I think, like 20 to 30 hours to the game.
And you said, you also mentioned Persona 4 Golden. Is that the same concept where it's like an additional aspect of Persona 4? Okay. All right, cool. So Persona 3, this is like an updated version of that Persona 3 game.
Yes. Well, this one is majorly updated. It's not like you're getting a remaster or minor updates. The original was a lot of like kind of point and click type until you actually got into the... like when you got to the actual dungeons, you could actually walk around and interact with stuff, but everything else was kind of like point and click, and a lot of, you know, you would read and interact with people in that kind of way. So this one updates it to make it where you're kind of you're running around, you're interacting, the game is seen in more of a 3D world than the 2D aspect. That this one was, original Persona 3 was like 2D and 3D, like, you know, some segments. And so it, yeah, this one is like an overhaul. I wouldn't say it's not like Final Fantasy 7 Remake where they took Final Fantasy 7 and expanded like the whole first part of Final Fantasy 7 Remake is maybe a couple hours in the original. This one is closer to the original game, but they updated it to where it looks, you know, it's more modern. So
that's cool.
I've really enjoyed it. Yeah, it's really cool seeing how the game was and then seeing how it is now. Persona 3 is the most popular for a lot of long-term Persona fans, mostly because Persona 3 is the game that really is the mold for the rest of the Persona games, but it's still tied to its roots. Persona is a spinoff of a series called Shin Megami Tensei. The roots of Persona 3 is a lot closer to Shin Megami Tensei, and some of those roots kind of leave the game as the games go on, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I just think that the Persona games kind of established their own identity, and so they're breaking away from the Shin Megami Tensei, but they still have the heart of it. A lot of the Personas in Persona are, you know, these creatures in Shin Megami, so...
Okay, yeah, all right. What, like, is it available to play on?
So, Persona 3 Reload, it's available on all the major consoles. It's not on the Switch. I don't know if they've made any announcements as far as making a version of it for the Switch, but it is for Xbox, it is for PlayStation, and it is on PC. For the Switch, you can play the original Persona 3, Persona 4 Golden, and Persona 5 Royal.
Okay, you can play the Reloaded. Is it because the graphics engine available on the Switch?
I'm honestly not 100% sure, because the Switch runs Persona 5 Royal pretty decently. It's a lot more animated. It, like, the graphics aren't really like heavy. It's not realistic. It's not like you're trying to play Final Fantasy 7 Remake on the Switch. I feel like if you ever try to play a game like that on the Switch, your Switch would probably literally explode. So maybe down the line we'll get that version on the Switch, but at least you do have a version of it that you can play on the Switch.
Do you recommend playing the first two games in the series before jumping into 3?
It's not necessary. It's almost like the Persona games are very similar to how Final Fantasy is done, where the only thing that's really connecting them is maybe like a couple of characters, but it's not connected story-wise. Like, you know, the protagonists, they're all different. The stories are all different. The world building is all different, but the personas are shared. You know how Final Fantasy, you have chocobos and all the magic is like the same. You might have the Moogles or whatnot. There's stuff that's shared within this universe, but the stories are different.
Okay. All right.
So
I'm thinking about, I mean, you've been talking about it for so long. Every time you say it, I'm thinking, like, maybe I should get into it.
Hey, you might like it, you know?
I might jump on, like, PlayStation 5.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Do you recommend Persona 3 Reloaded as a starting point?
I mean, it's so tough. Because I know a lot of people would say, like, yeah, definitely. But I feel like the one that has grabbed the most people is Persona 5. You know,
okay.
Because like, I don't know, have you heard of Persona before, like outside of me talking about it?
No.
No?
Not at all.
So, I mean, I've heard, so I know people who have talked about it, but like, I never really knew about Persona 3 and 4 until like, you know, just by chance, I picked up Persona 4 Golden for the Vita. So that's something that I didn't know. It's almost like Monster Hunter. Monster Hunter is very niche. I think in a way, Persona was niche, but it's like kind of gone to the forefront. So maybe 5, you know, 5 might be something that grabs you a little bit more. But it all depends, because like Persona 3 Reload is a lot darker theme-wise. And there's, you know, it even warns you in the beginning about stuff like bullying and, you know, just like that there might be some sensitive things. It gives you
the disclaimers.
Yeah, those disclaimers. Okay.
All right, so I'll think about it.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll see which one.
But you would be safe on jumping on either one. You don't have to worry about missing anything story-wise.
All right, so if I jumped on Persona 4 Golden, you'd be cool with that?
That's where I started, so.
Perfect, cool. Anything else you've been up to?
Nah, man, you know, just doing my thing, working on my stuff, working on my projects, continuing to learn my web development stuff. You know, it's a slow process, but it's getting there. Eventually, I've told you many times, I'd love to build us a proper website for our podcast. And I think that's going to be my big personal project when I actually get to a place to where I can do stuff either on my own or I know where to go to figure out stuff. But that's definitely something that's on my heart. I really, really want to do that. And I think it would be cool.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think any creative goal, whether it's creating a website or creating some sort of art piece, writing regularly, drawing regularly, I think it's a cool thing to work towards. And yeah, I think that the podcast definitely needs a new home.
Yes.
Besides just a hosting platform, basically. I think we need something a little bit stronger, a little more catchy.
Absolutely. But something that... It's something that, you know, I want to establish. And then when we actually update, when we release these episodes, that it's, you know, I don't have to go in and add it every time. It's like automatic. It's like, boom, it's there.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a super strong goal, especially creatively. I think that that is something that is easily, I mean, all right, it's not easily attainable. It's obviously a lot of work, but it's a cool goal to have. Eventually, I would like to write a novel. It's not going to happen overnight.
Oh, absolutely.
I think eventually it probably will happen, you know, if I keep writing regularly. So that's awesome.
Definitely. That's kind of what I've been up to. What about you? What have you been up to?
I've been busying myself with work. Otherwise, I've been working on my own projects for my Geek Critique YouTube channel. Specifically, I think I spoke about it last week. I'm pretty sure I have. I'm working on the MonsterVerse timeline. I have pretty much done all of my timeline notes for pretty much everything. I've done all the films, all the comic books that are tied into the MonsterVerse. And now I'm working on the TV shows. I've finished the, like, Netflix released a single season of a Kong anime show. I've done all the notes for that, and now I'm working on the Monarch Legacy of Monsters season 1. And I'm halfway through with that. I'm almost done with all the note-taking for the MonsterVerse, and then I can begin my writing process of the timeline. That's kind of how my process works. For the most part, I take all the notes that I can first, then I jump into writing, and then I record and start editing. But for the MonsterVerse, this was a more tedious project because I've never taken any notes for it. I've always just been an observer and an enjoyer of the movies, the shows, whatever. So I had to go back and be meticulous about, like, okay, I want this to be mentioned in my video. I don't want this to be mentioned in my video. So it takes a lot of work on that end, which is not something I'm used to, because like with Marvel, which I'm very in tune with, like, okay, this is a very important thing to write down. I'll do that immediately.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how my brain is hardwired with Marvel. With other franchises, I'm still kind of working my way up towards that so that I can create big timeline videos that have not only like one, like, you know, I can easily say this movie happens here, this show happens here, this comic happens here, but to have a narrative that like sweeps throughout all of that, that's a lot of work. You know, I have to really know my stuff for something like that. So that's what I'm working on right now. It's a long time coming. I've been doing the notes for this for a little over a month at this point, and I'm almost done. So I'm actually very excited about how this video is turning out. I think it's going to be a good one.
Very nice, man. And when that video comes out, we'll definitely plug it in the show notes. We have your YouTube in the show notes, so if any of y'all are interested, any new people coming in that they're interested in seeing your YouTube channel, it's in the show notes. Go check it out. There's a lot of really cool stuff. Expert, so...
Official, unofficial.
You know, you're officially like unofficial, you know?
I appreciate that. Should we jump into Godzilla?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was interesting going back and watching this movie because, you know, they've definitely done a lot to clean up the look of it, especially like I watched it on Max, and I know that obviously had I seen this movie back then, the clarity of the picture wouldn't look like the way it was.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's definitely gone through a couple of remasters over the years. The version on Max actually is a version only available to Criterion.
Oh yeah, isn't Criterion a collection, right?
Yeah, so the Criterion collection, they make DVDs. I mean, that's how they started. They find niche videos or, you know, like movies that don't necessarily lend themselves to big blockbuster release that are generally on the more artsy side of the entertainment value that you would normally get from, you know, movies. And they sign deals with the studios, with the directors to make physical media for, you know, some of these films. I have a couple. I have like probably 7 or 8 on my shelf over there. I'm looking at them right now. I have Citizen Kane. I have A Hard Day's Night. I have Mulholland Drive, Twin Peaks. A couple of them. I have Princess Bride. They're all like Criterion Collection versions of those releases. And alongside them, they usually have, you know, a couple like special DVD extras that you wouldn't normally get on a normal DVD extra. And I think that's kind of what sets Criterion apart is they really try to give you as much value as possible with each release. Because the Godzilla stuff that we were streaming for Godzilla 1954 was over Max, I don't know that they have any of the extra stuff that would normally come on like a Criterion DVD or the Criterion streaming service. I'm happy that it was on Max to begin with, just in general, just because we were able to, you know, cover it for our, you know, production of this episode. So that was really cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. And man, you know, there's a lot of things that kind of was sitting in my mind and that I was a little excited to talk about. There was a lot about this film that while I was watching it, you know, I kept on thinking about Godzilla Minus One, and it really made me appreciate Godzilla Minus One a lot more because it showed that the creators of that one really appreciated the original Godzilla. And they, you know, there was a lot that it felt like I said, it was almost like watching this movie again for the first time, but there was a lot familiar about it because we had seen Godzilla Minus One.
I totally agree. And it's funny that you said that because while I was watching it yesterday, Jen was working on her laptop for, you know, for her job, for school, whatever. And she was telling me today that like every time she looked up, she was just like, oh, this scene reminds me of Godzilla Minus One. And I was thinking that throughout the entire thing. I was just like, man, is Godzilla Minus One just kind of like a really modernized adaptation of the original Godzilla 1954? And I think it is in some ways. You know, I think it's meant to be, obviously it's its own thing. I don't think anyone's going to, you know, argue that. But it is meant to emulate the feel, the terror, the overall sentiment of post-war Japan that you had with the original film.
And something that really sat in my mind about the original is that, you know, yes, that movie definitely has that post-World War II feel, you know, this original one. And the insanity is that everybody in that film lived through that period, lived through World War II.
I know.
Because this was not even 10 years after the end of it.
Yeah. So let me put it this way. The people making this movie were closer in time to the bombs dropping in Japan than we are to Godzilla coming out in 2014, the Gareth Edwards movie that we covered not so long ago. It's just like to think about that difference kind of puts time into perspective and the time span of films and Hollywood and all that. So, yeah, anyone going through this movie, anyone filming this movie, anyone creating this movie and experiencing it at that time would have those memories of war, you know, bombs,
yes,
A-bombs, H-bombs. Yeah, so it's...
There's an interesting scene on the train that a woman talks about. She's like, you know, I just barely survived the bombing in Nagasaki. Now I have to deal with this Godzilla thing. I was like, dude, how many people in this film actually had to survive actual bombing stuff? Like, it's how crazy close to home did that, you know, is this stuff hitting when they're talking about this post-war stuff? They're talking about nuclear testing, H-bomb testing. You know, it's like, dude, it's insane how close to World War II this movie was and how much that war influenced this movie. It's written all over this. It's so prominently featured in this movie because of how close it was, man. Dude, like,
that movie
after World War II, it was closer to World War II than you and I are to high school.
Yeah, dude, it's absolutely insane. And I consider myself a young person. Like, I don't consider myself, like, an old fogey at this point. But yeah, it's nuts how much World War II is written all over this movie.
Absolutely.
Even, like, there's one scene where there's a mother and her two children, like, and they're cowering from the destruction that is Godzilla, terroring through Tokyo. And she tells her kids, "We'll be with your father soon." And I'm just like, dude, that's deep. That's heavy. You know, she's basically telling her kids, "We're gonna die. And it's gonna be okay. Because we're gonna be with your dad." And that's, dude, I got choked up at it because I don't know how war feels. I'm a 32-year-old dude who's never been through any type of battle like that. But these people experienced that firsthand with the firebombings in literally every Japanese city outside of Kyoto, as well as the nuclear bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's no way anyone watching that movie in Japan did not have that background information going on at all times.
And it's hard not to watch Godzilla and think about how it's directly influenced by World War II, because Godzilla really is, I mean, he represents nuclear power. That's really what he was based off of, you know?
Yeah.
That was the inspiration. He's this creature that was created by bomb testing in the water. And I thought it was really cool when Godzilla was showing up and he's bringing up all these, like, little
trilobites.
Yes, these were extinct millions of years ago, and now these things are coming up in Godzilla's footprint. What is down in this, like, little, like, he's like in this, like, ravine in the water, or like valley, or like deep point in the water.
Basically, like, he's been dormant for so long that I think, like, currently our understanding of, like, the Godzilla mythology from pretty much, like, a number of different mythologies that have popped up over the years is that Godzilla is an ancient creature that existed at a time when our atmosphere in general was much more nuclear, in, or, like, there's much more radiation in the atmosphere, like prehistory, basically. And I think that is the idea of, like, him bringing these ancient fossils that are, like, 200 million years old up as if they were new creatures. You know, I think that he was dormant for so long because there was nothing radioactive enough to wake him up until the nuclear tests basically woke him up. I think that's what the story was trying to say.
You know, something that I was really impressed by the acting in this movie. Like, yeah, like I said, it'd been a long time. And then you think Godzilla movies had kind of been, you know, made fun of over the years, that you're thinking that they're all kind of corny. Well, not all of them are, but, like, you know, in this original, like, you got some really, really good acting. Even for a Japanese film where sometimes it could be a little overboard with some of the acting, they weren't really all that crazy overboard. They had some really, like, you know, serious scenes. They interacted. It didn't seem over the top. I was really impressed how well everything was acted out. It made me think that even with the way that they were able to scale things up with miniatures and even with people with Godzilla in the background, like, that they even were able to, they had the technology and even the thought process to like be able to create this stuff really like blew me away watching this. Like I had such an appreciation for the limited technology that they had, that they were really able to do a lot.
I was really impressed by, you know, there was a couple scenes that I was really impressed by, now that you bring it up, in terms of like how they were able to superimpose two images onto each other. One of them, I mean, there was a couple when he was walking through Tokyo, and you could see the people running in the streets below, and mm-hmm. he was in the distance, and there was fire all over the city.
Yes.
Excellent. Dude, like, there were so many scenes I was just like, that's an album cover right there. Like, that's beautiful. Like,
it looked really good. Yeah, this movie really does hold up very well. And the fact that, you know, it has been taken care of, you know, you have the Criterion Collection that, like, really, it just, you know, that and with, yeah, like you said, you know, what they're able to do with, you know, superimposing. And, you know, honestly, when I saw Godzilla, you know, obviously I chuckled a little bit, but it really did bring a smile to my face, because I was like, this is, you know, Godzilla, you know, this is a man in a rubber suit right here.
This started it all.
I was like, you know, there was a couple moments where he like looking over the suit doesn't look amazing, but like I still love it, man. I still loved it. I was able to, yes.
Yeah.
You know, it, and his atomic breath.
It was pretty much just a blow dryer.
Dude, yeah, I started laughing when he was doing it, like, when he was, like, doing the... But I was impressed because of, like, you know, he was doing that, and then they were able to, like, give it that melting, like, effect, and it looked really cool.
Yeah. I think they were going more for, like, radiation.
Yeah. I totally got that. It glowed, like, when he was blowing on it. That's, like, yeah, it's not, like, I would call that... definitely atomic breath. It makes more sense to call that atomic breath. The current Godzilla definitely shoots out like an atomic beam, you know, now.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and then when it comes to like the legendary monsterverse stuff, it's more of like blue fire. And I'm sure there is some radiation involved in there, but yeah, it's not the same as when it originally came. One thing I was pleasantly surprised by that I didn't remember from the first time I watched this was the opening credits. I thought it was funny and also kind of cool that they had like different roars from Godzilla throughout the opening credits, and they were playing the like the theme song and
yes!
everything. I'm into this.
And it's insane because cool. You listen to the theme in that movie and you listen to the theme that they play in Godzilla Minus One, pretty much identical, except obviously it's, Godzilla Minus One, and it sounds a lot better, but it's literally the same theme, dude.
It's the same orchestration. It's the same notes on the same paper. It's just a new recording. Yeah, so that was impressive. That was definitely impressive.
You know, it's a shame that these people that were in the original film couldn't see, you know, maybe some of the younger ones might have seen Godzilla Minus One, but it's sad that a lot of these people didn't get to see like what they inspired, because Godzilla Minus One, you have all these Godzilla movies, but Godzilla Minus One is definitely a love letter to the original Godzilla. It's so good.
There's some interesting parallels that I think are more like thematic as opposed to like a one for one. So like a one for one for me is the obvious, like the reporters.
Yes.
When they were reporting the destruction of Tokyo.
Yes, dude. I thought the same thing.
The first couple lines, I thought they were the exact same like lines from the original movie, as in Godzilla Minus One. I was just like, this. It seems like it was like a one for one sort of thing. Obviously,
yes.
There was some things changed because they were on like a tower versus like the top of a building. But so for those of you who don't remember or who haven't seen Godzilla Minus One, there's a scene where there are like four reporters, like one of them is capturing video, one of them is capturing audio, and one of them is actually talking into the microphone and is explaining like what Godzilla is doing, and he's tearing through Tokyo and he's destroying and leveling buildings and destruction is rampant, we don't know if we're gonna get out of here, blah blah blah. They have that exact same scene in Godzilla 1954. It's on a radio tower instead of the top of a building. And I don't remember what happens to the radio crew in Godzilla Minus One, but in Godzilla 1954, Godzilla, you know, tears down the radio tower, and that's it for them.
Yeah. The evacuation announcement was, yeah, like the same. Absolutely the same.
That's cool.
Yeah, man. Like I said, watching through this film dude, it really does. It gave me so, like I said, so much more of an appreciation for Godzilla Minus One, because I'm like, dude, like, they really took a lot of inspiration from this film, man. The Godzilla in Godzilla Minus One is literally the Godzilla in this movie, but obviously not like lopsided looking. They like, you know, gave him more of a symmetrical look, but the texture and like the look is so close to the original, man.
Connection, an obvious like one for one connection between Godzilla Minus One and Godzilla 1954 is Oda Island, which is a fictional island. We talked about it briefly on our last episode. That's the island that has the mythology or the legend of a Godzilla type creature.
Yeah.
I looked it up. It's not an actual Japanese island. It's an island created for the 1954 film that on that island, they have a legend of a Godzilla type creature. So it's not a new creature. Godzilla isn't a new thing. He's been around for a very, very, very long time. And the nuclear testing woke him up. That's basically the story of Oda Island. And that's an easy connection between Godzilla Minus One and Godzilla 1954, because obviously Oda Island doesn't exist, but it exists in both of these versions of the movies. And both of these versions of the movies have that legend of an ancient creature called Godzilla. So I think that's pretty cool.
And, you know, about 20 years later, you know, we get Oda, the creator of One Piece.
How can you forget? Yes, the... It's the journey of
there's the connection friends. Right there. You heard it here, folks. Godzilla and One Piece are connected by this little piece of information. No, I was kidding.
I was actually just telling Jen, like, we were having dinner. We were at a Mexican restaurant, and I was thinking about, like, One Piece, and I'm just like, man, I stopped reading the manga. I stopped watching the anime. But I have this strong urge to watch One Piece. I have this strong urge to continue reading the story. I know that the story gets better and different and it's stranger moving forward. And I want to experience that. So I went ahead and I ordered the next 5 volumes of the manga. Should be getting them soon. But yeah, I'm excited to jump back into the One Piece world just because, you know, I've been following like random like people on TikTok who are like fantasy aficionados, and people who've read One Piece consider it amongst their top 5 fantasy stories ever. And I want to experience that, you know? Like, I've only experienced the East Blue saga as of this point. Like, I haven't experienced anything past East Blue or Logue Town. I haven't even gotten to Logue Town, technically.
Dude, you gotta get to the Grand Line, man. Grand Line.
Get to the Grand Line.
Dude, that's where Oda Island is. You get to the Grand Line, you get to Godzilla, man.
Is that... Okay, all right, well, that's good. All right, so back
to Godzilla.
There is actually a lot of large creatures when you get there, but yeah.
Yeah, but I want to get back into One Piece, like, legit. Like, I've been thinking about it. It's been, like, in the back of my head for a bit now. I'm excited to dive back into that universe, but we're talking about Godzilla here. We have a lot to talk about with Godzilla. There's a lot of scenes where they discuss his radioactivity. You know, like, everywhere he goes... they have to bring a Geiger counter to determine his radioactive signature is or whatever, to make sure it's safe to be where he has been. And that in itself is part and parcel of life after the nuclear bombs were dropped on Japan, because there was a period after the end of the war where those two cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were unlivable because of nuclear fallout. Obviously, that's not the case today. They're very livable now. It was a very short period of time, but it was dangerous at the time, you know, and there are people around that area who weren't directly affected by the bomb immediately had effects later on. So that was in the public consciousness at the time when this movie was coming out. And that's another one of those things that this movie is commenting on. But the biggest commentary that I can think of in terms of World War II ramifications is near the end of the movie, they really start to dig into the oxygen destroyer as this next big super weapon. They mention A-bombs. That's what was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They mention H-bombs, which is the next big thing after A-bombs. H-bombs were never, like, dropped on any civilian cities or anything like that, but they were used in testing, and they tested all the way up through the 50s and 60s. They even mentioned some of the testing in the movie as what woke up Godzilla. Dr. Sarazawa, a character who has a cool little eye patch, creates what's known as the Oxygen Destroyer and introduces it to Emiko, which they don't really explain, like, their relationship too much. Emiko and Dr. Sarazawa, but it's kind of implied that Emiko and Dr. Sarazawa were once a thing, or almost a thing. Like, they were close enough where, like, introducing Emiko's fiancé in Ogata was kind of weird, to a point where they didn't actually introduce themselves as a couple to Dr. Sarazawa. Emiko is introduced to Dr. Sarazawa's oxygen destroyer in a little contained test within a fish tank. And she freaks out, because obviously that's a very terrible power to be exposed to. And throughout the rest of the movie, Dr. Sarazawa is very adamant that he does not want this going out into the world. And, you know, in 2024, watching this in 2024, post-Oppenheimer, post-Godzilla Minus One, I have to, like, use that knowledge or preconception of what it would be like to create a weapon of this magnitude in a movie like this. And I think that's what they were commenting on. Like, Dr. Sarazawa was kind of an Oppenheimer type character, where, like, he didn't want his bomb to blow up civilians. He was doing it because he could. He was doing it because it was the next step in scientific knowledge. It was a breakthrough. But when it came down to using it to take out life, that was obviously something Oppenheimer did not want. You know, if you watch the movie,
yeah,
he kind of drew the line there. He was very adamant that maybe we should, you know, stop. He tried to stop the military at that point. With Godzilla 1954, Dr. Sarazawa tried to stop anyone from even knowing that he was working on this device, because he realized the effects that the A-bomb, the H-bomb, had on the global socioeconomic system, where, like, just because they use that, that changed the world forever. Like, yeah. They realized at that moment that every superpower in the world is going to try to attain that power, and they're going to leverage it against each other. And that's what ended up happening with the Cold War, even after this movie was released, you know? So at this point in 1954, when the Soviet Union was still fairly weak comparatively to, like, when they were in, like, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the directors of this movie had the foresight to, like, really dig into that mindset of, like, what would happen if we created a bomb that's even worse than the H-bomb? And that's what they kind of did with the oxygen destroyer. They didn't want that getting out into the world. And I think that's such a cool narrative, you know? It's just like, we saw firsthand what A-bomb could do on our domestic soil. We don't want to be the creator of the next big thing.
Right.
That's dope.
Destroy all his notes and stuff on it too.
Yeah, and I think Dr. Sarazawa is probably the most interesting character of this movie for a number of reasons. Not just because of that. Obviously, he's the one who has the plot device that ends the threat. So that's interesting in and of itself. But when it comes to a parallel between this movie and Godzilla Minus One, and this movie and Legendary's MonsterVerse, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to Dr. Sarazawa, because he sacrifices his life to destroy the monster. But in Godzilla Minus One, the main character does not sacrifice himself, even though he wants to. He plans to. He does not, though. And I think that's the big difference between Godzilla Minus One and Godzilla 1954, is that, like, life is valuable. There's no point giving it up.
Even though there is a desire for this weapon, the oxygen destroyer, to not get out there, he didn't want to use it on life.
100%. I think in the context of this movie, it makes more sense for him to take his own life, because he's afraid that some other organization is going to get him and use his knowledge to create another one of these devices.
Which is valid. I mean, honestly, in that time, probably.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that sentiment. And I understand his fear about, like, it being used for, you know, something other than destroying a giant lizard creature. But let's talk about, if you'll allow me, Dr. Sarazawa versus the Dr. Sarazawa of the MonsterVerse.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really interesting comparison, because for those of you who remember, Dr. Sarazawa in the first Godzilla movie, Godzilla 2014, the first American version of this, you know what I'm talking about. Godzilla 2014, they had a Dr. Sarazawa. He was famously quoted as, like, let them fight. You know, he was the guy who told the U.S. Army to basically let Godzilla fight the Mutos, because he knew that Godzilla could win, and he's, like, a natural balance for nature and all that. Well, in Godzilla King of the Monsters, which is the third movie, so Godzilla 2014, then there's Kong Skull Island, and then there's Godzilla King of the Monsters. In that movie, a rogue party releases King Ghidorah, or they call it Monster Zero in this movie. They release Rodan, and they release Mothra, and blah blah blah, and it culminates a big monster fight. But there's a point in the midway point of the movie where the U.S. Army uses an experimental weapon known as the Oxygen Destroyer to blow up Godzilla and King Ghidorah. Only Godzilla is, like, mortally affected by this bomb called the Oxygen Destroyer, which is obviously a parallel to the original 1954 film. But the interesting thing about that is that Dr. Serizawa did not want him to be blown up. He did not want him to use the Oxygen Destroyer on Godzilla. There's a parallel between Dr. Serizawa and Godzilla, where in the original 1954 film, Dr. Serizawa sacrifices himself to explode the bomb in front of Godzilla, killing both him and Godzilla. But in the newer movie, the 2019 movie Godzilla King of the Monsters, to bring Godzilla back in action after the Oxygen Destroyer, the Monarch team dives into Godzilla's lair, the Earth's crust, basically, and they release a nuclear bomb. Dr. Serizawa himself walks up to Godzilla to basically, like, ignite this nuclear bomb, which is what Godzilla feeds on. So it's actually something that will, like, basically wake him up. Dr. Serizawa in the 2019 Godzilla King of the Monsters actually sacrifices himself using a bomb to wake Godzilla up, versus Dr. Serizawa blowing himself up to kill Godzilla in 1954. I just think that parallel is super cool. And it's all based around the Oxygen Destroyer. Did that make any sense to you?
No. I think that's really cool. And, you know, it's been a while since I had seen those movies, and even longer since I had seen this. So, honestly, I wouldn't even have been able to put two and two together. But if I had watched those movies again, then I would have been like, oh my gosh, I remember this from the original.
Yeah, it's just cool that, like, Dr. Serizawa of the 1954 film is there to blow himself up as well as Godzilla, versus the 2019 version of Dr. Serizawa is there to blow himself up to resuscitate Godzilla. You know, it's almost like a roundabout thank you in a way. I don't know. I can't even explain it. But it's cool. It's a cool parallel.
No, that definitely is. That's cool. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because it really shows how much this original movie has permeated throughout these different films. And, you know, I mean, the 2014 one obviously kicked off a MonsterVerse, you know, kind of its own contained universe, whereas, like, all these other Godzilla movies were kind of like one-offs, or, you know, like very small, like not like a universe in this kind of way. Though, I mean, we have had, you know, Godzilla versus King Kong.
Yeah, so the early Toho films, like up until the late 70s, they were all one universe, starting from like Godzilla 1954 up until, I think it's the late 70s. And then there was like a 12-year period where they didn't do anything. And then in the 90s, they started it up again, where there was like a new universe. More recently, within the past 20, 25 years, all the Japanese films have been one-off stories, if I remember correctly. Godzilla Minus One is one of those one-off stories, just like Shin Godzilla is, so on and so forth.
It's definitely, like I said, man, watching through this film really gave me an appreciation for the series. Like you said, you know, there's been some really good movies, and then there's been some doozies, but I'm glad that this movie that kicked off the Gojira series and the kaiju,
the whole genre, really,
you know, yeah, exactly, that it was a strong start, and it went from anywhere from the man in the rubber suit to the people, you know, just everybody. Like, it really seemed that they really put their all into this movie. And I applaud them even more because, dude, it hadn't even been a decade since World War II happened. 10 years is not enough time to clean up all of that. They're still dealing with the devastation from World War II. And the fact that a film like this, that time, kicked off an entire genre, a character that is transcended and just, it's relevant. It was relevant with our grandparents and it's relevant now today, you know, to us. We all know these characters.
Yeah.
It's something that's just going to keep going. And it's insane how you could ask anybody. Everybody's going to know who Godzilla is. You could live in a cave your whole life and still know who Godzilla is.
I was even thinking, like, in the intro, before they even showed any footage of the movie, they had, like, the credits of the movie. There was, like, a playlist of the different roars that he did throughout the movie. It all sounded like Godzilla, like the Godzilla that we know and love today. It's crazy how much nothing has changed. I mean, even the scales on his back, when he would, like, do his atomic breath, even those lit up. It's just like the basic DNA of this giant angry creature has stuck around for almost 70 years.
Dude, the look of Godzilla has practically stayed the same too. I mean, they've obviously updated the look, but, you know, and we've had a couple, you know, they try to change him a couple times. You know, that one American Godzilla movie where they try to make Godzilla slash, it was like a T-Rex slash Godzilla. I don't know what they were going on, but I mean, for the most part,
Jurassic Park.
And for the most part, it's just been this bipedal lizard creature thing that has looked the same, almost like this chunky destructive force, dude. Like, I mean, you look at Godzilla now and you look at Godzilla in the legendary universe and it's the same, just not a man in a rubber suit and updated graphics, you know?
What's cool is that, like, you can take someone who's like, you can take someone from the 50s who's just watched this Godzilla movie and you put them into 2014, 2019, whenever there was a Godzilla movie that was recent, there's no way think that's a different monster. That it's just like a bigger, better version of it. This is the original. This is the one that all of this is based off of. And I think that's so cool.
I agree, man.
There's one shot so much that I wanted to talk about briefly. There's a scene where they had like 300 Asian schoolgirls singing.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And it takes, like, the scene, you know, it kind of like spends a whole minute panning through the room as these girls sing, and I'm just like, what a beautiful shot, because it's one take. So there's a couple shots in this movie that like are weirdly cut. So there's a couple scenes where like Emiko in particular, like you could tell they like spliced two cuts together, Emiko being the girl in the movie. You could tell that they spliced two cuts together because it'd be like she would be looking sad and then the next scene, like literally less than a second later, she'd be like screaming and crying. And there was a couple like jump cuts like that just didn't work, but maybe they worked back in the 50s.
Yeah.
Today they wouldn't work, you know, it would be bad editing today. Even that, like seeing that early in the film, I was just like, the editing's gonna be kind of blah, it's not gonna really wow me any. But seeing the scene with like all the schoolgirls singing and it was just panning through them slowly as they sang this song to, like, you know, uplift Japan in this dark time.
Yeah.
I was really touched, dude. It looked beautiful. Like, it was clean. It was clearly on, like, a dolly in a way that, like, there was no shaky cam or anything. It was just, like, it felt like a very modern scene, like a long-take modern scene. And I thought that was so cool, man.
Yeah, I thought that there's that one scene that was really interesting. Remember, like, an island was being attacked, and it looked like a monsoon that was going on, but it was Godzilla, yeah. Dude.
They did a really good job of like creating monsoon effects
for a
model village, because that's what it is. It was a model village that they were destroying. Dude, it looked great. Like it was crazy. Even like some of the ships that they had like bobbing up on the water and being destroyed slowly, I was really impressed by it. There's even some shots where they had the Japanese Navy clearly bomb the water and they filmed that. I don't know if you noticed that. Like they're like, there were like obvious real bombs in the water, which I was like not expecting at all.
And considering the fact that they had a limited budget, they had to create this film essentially about destruction, which there's a lot that goes into that. You know, they had constraints with making this film. It wasn't an easy film to make, but they did it, man. They overcame whatever they had. I'm not gonna like, you know, crap on it, obviously, but obviously some of the budget didn't go into the suit, but I love it anyway.
You know what I was surprised by talking about budget is like all the extras that were involved in this movie. Like there was a lot of extras. after the village is destroyed, there's the scene, I think it was after the village was destroyed, maybe it was like before, but there was a scene where after a couple of ships have been destroyed, there's like a group of like 100, 150 people on the beach, like looking out at the water. And I'm just like, that's a lot of extras that they just got for this scene. And there's another scene in Tokyo when it's being destroyed that you see just like hundreds of people like moving all at once. And I'm just like, they literally got a whole village to act for this movie. Like, how did they do that? I'm consistently like surprised by like old films like this. Like, how do they manage such huge groups? And it's impressive. I'm glad we did Godzilla 1954, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. It was nice, like I said, going back and being able to watch this film and just really being delighted to see that there's a lot about it that does hold up, and it starts off strong, man. It starts off this series very strong. It doesn't just throw Godzilla right at you. It builds up to Godzilla, just like Godzilla Minus One. Like, it, I mean, you do get Godzilla in the beginning in that one, you know, but when he's younger, like a smaller Godzilla, but it builds up to like the actual Godzilla that we know throughout the film. And that's what this original does. You know, you're hearing a lot about Godzilla, you know, you have that moment where he kind of like pops his head over that mountain like, yeah, people are running from him. He's like,
it looked really funny, y'all do? But it was also kind of cool.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, it was like in that moment I'm like, you know, Godzilla's just like popping up like, hey, what y'all doing over there?
Yeah. Anthony, what do you say we continue our giant monster discussion next week? Maybe not with Godzilla, but maybe with another movie. I don't know.
All right, we will cover the Phantom of the Opera.
I'm 100% down. Speaking of Phantom of the Opera, no joke, maybe about a month or two ago, my wife Jen watched Phantom of the Opera. I think it was the 2003 movie.
I remember when y'all had that like soundtrack on repeat.
Dude, it's a good movie. Like, it's actually like really good. Jen had she'd never seen it before. But anyway, I'm thinking more like giant monster, not just like, you know,
monstrous small humans. Phantom.
What
person
do you think about Kong Skull Island, the 2017 film, the follow-up to Godzilla 2014, but it's about Kong instead of Godzilla?
I suppose. No, I'm just kidding. No, definitely, that'd be cool.
All right, let's keep this monster jam rolling. This monster mash,
you know.
I could see it in Anthony's face that like I said monster mash before he was able to say it, and he was pissed.
It's like Dakota beat me to the punch, you know.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening to us here at Project Geekology for our 70th episode, all about Gojira 1954. Next week we're going to be covering Kong Skull Island, the 2017 film by Legendary and Toho. We're very excited about that, just to jump into another monster. But yeah, Anthony, anything else to say about Godzilla 1954?
If y'all are Godzilla fans and you haven't seen this film or haven't seen it in a while, definitely go watch it or revisit it. It's a delight to see. It's a delight just to watch the movie that kicked it all off, and honestly didn't just kick off the whole Godzilla series, but kicked off the entire giant monsters fighting each other era, the series, the kaijus fighting.
Yeah, 100%, and I couldn't say it any better myself. So yeah, definitely check out Godzilla 1954 if you have Max, the streaming service. If you have that, it's available there, as well as a number of Godzilla movies. They have a whole bunch
of them. So many. I was scrolling through. I was like, oh my gosh, dude, there's so many Godzilla movies.
There's more Godzilla movies than I remember there being. Dude. But yeah, definitely check them out. Specifically that first one, because it's probably considered among the best. And for good reason. But anyways, we will see you next week for our 71st episode, specifically Kong Skull Island. So be there or be square. If you want to check out anything outside of the podcast, be sure to check our show notes where we have all of our socials individually and, you know, as like the podcast socials and stuff. So follow us there, and we'll see you next time.
Alrighty, bye.